Good evening, everyone. It's good to see everybody out tonight. It's good to be with fellow Christians. We have a lot of material to cover tonight, so we'll get right into it. We're in the book of Genesis, as we have been all this quarter, and in particular tonight, we're going to be talking a lot about Jacob. We're in the period of the patriarchs, as far as the Waldron outline is concerned. If you break up the book of Genesis into two major sections, you had the first 11 chapters that talk about the creation, the flood, and the scattering of the people. And then the last part talks about four main individuals, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And of course, again, we'll be talking about Jacob a lot tonight. We've talked about a lot of different individuals during the study. The main character is, of course, God. We started off with Him creating the heavens and the earth. And the first people, Adam and Eve, they were in the Garden of Eden. They had two sons to start off with, Cain and Abel. Cain killed Abel. And then Seth came along afterwards, essentially in a replacement for Abel. And it's through him that the rest of the characters in the Old Testament, we see that line. Noah would have been in Seth's line. And he was the one, obviously, who built the ark. And he had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem, then, is the one that we see that the line going through that we see most of the characters that we read about. Abraham would have been through Shem's line, and he married Sarah. But he also married Sarah's maid, Hagar, and had Ishmael. We also read about Bethuel, who would have been Abraham's nephew through Nahor, his brother, and his great-nephew Laban. And we read about Isaac, his son, through Sarah, Mary and Rebecca, and finally their two sons, Jacob and Esau, that Brent taught to us about on Sunday. Several different places that we've talked about. The Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve were to start off with. The mountains of Ararat, where the ark rested after the flood. The Tower of Babel, the area of Babel, where the languages were confused and they built the tower. We had the land of Ur, where Abraham came up out of there. He went to Haran. He went down into Canaan, went down into Egypt, and came back up into Canaan. And most of our story is in the land of Canaan. Leading up to our lesson tonight, Isaac is about 137 years old, and that would make Jacob and Esau about 77, since Isaac was 60 when the boys were born. Esau hates Jacob because of the way that Jacob has treated him and has taken away his birthright and has taken away his blessing. And so he is planning on killing Jacob whenever Isaac dies. Again, Isaac's 137. I believe Isaac lives to be 180, so he's got another 43 years left. But at this point, it seems like Esau thinks that Isaac doesn't have much longer. He can barely see, if it can see at all. Rebecca finds out that Esau wants to kill Jacob, so she says, "I want to send you off to Haran to my family up there for a few days." And of course, we find out in the lesson tonight and into the lesson on the next lesson that those few days turn into 20 years. She tells Isaac, her husband, she says, "I don't want Jacob to marry any of the people of the land." Remember, Esau has married two Hittite women from the land, and she says, "Jacob, I don't want Jacob to marry a Hittite lady or a lady from the land of Canaan." So Isaac tells Isaac, "You go and take a wife. Don't take one from the land of Canaan. Go up to Paddan Aram and take a wife from the daughters of Laban." In other words, go marry one of your cousins. And like we've said, Esau and Jacob are 77 at this point. Esau's been married for 37 years to these Canaanite wives that he has. When he sees that the Canaanite wives are not making his parents particularly happy, and that Isaac is going off to marry somebody off, Jacob is going to marry somebody off in the family, he marries somebody off in the family too, except for through Ishmael. He marries Ishmael's daughter. And so she would kind of be a cousin for him also, Abraham's granddaughter through the Keturah. That's a lot. Any questions or comments about that? Okay, so that's kind of the background of where we are. What have we seen? We've seen favoritism. We've seen where Rebekah favored Jacob. We've seen where Isaac favored Esau. And we saw the lies where Jacob said, "Yes, I'm Esau," to his father Isaac. And he deceived his father Isaac. We see the hate that Esau had for Jacob. And we see the different ways that spouses were selected. When Abraham sends up his servant to find a spouse for Isaac. But we also see how Esau marries the people of the land, and how that Isaac and Rebekah are sending Jacob up to marry somebody in the family. But we also see the promises of God. Those three main promises of the land, nation, and seed have been promised to Abraham. And those same promises were given to Isaac. And we'll see tonight that those same promises were given to Jacob. Okay, Sunday's lesson will be chapters 31 through 33, 31 through 33, and tonight most of it is through 28 through 30. Okay, the context is basically we're going to be learning how Jacob got his family, his wives and his children, and who he got them from. Where does it all occur at? Jacob starts off in Beersheba and leaves his family there. He goes up to Haran, but on the way he stops at a place called Luz that he renames to Bethel. So, at a high level for today's lesson, Jacob leaves Beersheba, and we've seen where that is in the southern part of the country before. And he is going up to stay with his uncle, Laban, Rebekah's brother, and supposedly for a few days. On the way up there, he stops at a place called Luz. And it seems like to me he's just camping out underneath the stars. And he sleeps there that night. He puts a rock up next to his head, supposedly, I guess, as a pillow. And he has a dream. And it's a really neat dream. And he sees this ladder that's on the earth, and it reaches up into heaven. And there's angels ascending and descending on this. And the Lord speaks to him and reiterates those three promises to him and says that I'm going to be with you wherever you go. He wakes up in the morning and he says, this must be the house of God. And so he renames it to Bethel, Bethel, house of God. And he goes on from there and he goes on to Haran, to Laban's house. And he works 14 years for Rachel. He winds up marrying Leah and Rachel both. He didn't mean to. He meant to marry Rachel. But he marries both of them. And while he's there in Haran, he has 12 kids, 11 boys and one girl. And he's working as a shepherd while he's up there for Laban, his father-in-law. Even after he works those 14 years, we'll see where he works another 6 years for his father-in-law, Laban. So that's kind of the general outline of what we're talking about tonight. And we'll get to more details. Questions or comments about that? Okay. Rebekah wanted Jacob to marry somebody other than somebody in the land. But she also wanted Jacob to get away from Esau because she knew that Esau wanted to kill him. And she's part of the reason why Esau wanted to kill him. So Rebekah says to Isaac, I don't want Jacob marrying somebody from this area. And so he tells Jacob that. You go up to Haran, to Rebekah's family, to her, to your uncle, and marry a cousin of yours that's up there. How much interaction or how much news they had from what was going on in Haran, and knowing about, if Laban even had daughters or not, I don't know how much they would have known, but that's where he sent him. And so he leaves Beersheba, and he's going on about a 500-mile journey. You know, we talked a week or so ago when we were talking about how Abraham sent his servant up there to find a wife for Isaac. There was 1,000 miles, 500 up there, 500 back. So a 1,000-mile journey. And Jacob, yeah, there we go. Jacob thinks that he's going to have the same kind of journey. Again, we've seen other maps that kind of give us the idea. This doesn't give you the full journey. This starts at Shechem, which is a little north of Jerusalem, which would be north of Beersheba, where he's starting from. But it goes up to Haran. And probably he would have taken the hill country to go up through there. And again, that's another picture that shows us where approximately where Bethel was, close to Ai. And again, going through the hill country to go up there. And Beersheba there at the bottom showing its presence in alignment with the bottom part of the Dead Sea. So he leaves to go up. How far is Bethel from Beersheba? I can't say for sure. Maybe some of you can tell me, but I've seen estimates from 50 to 80 miles. So he may not have gotten to Luz on that first night. However many nights he got there, he stops there for the night. Because it's getting late. He puts a rock up next to his head. He goes to sleep, and he has the dream. And it's the, you know, we tell our little kids about this dream, about these angels going up and down this ladder. Ladders on top of the earth, reaches up into heaven. And it reminds you of what is said in John chapter 1 and verse 51. We'll actually read verses 47 through 51. So in John chapter 1, beginning in verse 47, this is when Jesus met Nathanael. It says, Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom is no deceit. Nathanael said to him, How do you know me? Jesus answered and said to him, Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. Nathanael answered and said to him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Jesus answered and said to him, Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these. And he said to him, Most assuredly I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. I think, especially when you take these two together, you see that Jesus is saying, I am the way to heaven. No man comes to the Father except through me. And so, Jacob has this great dream. He sees all this going on this ladder. And the Lord stood above the ladder. And the Lord told Jacob, I am giving you the land where you are laying. The land promise, just like he had said to Abraham. Your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. The nation promise, just like he had said to Abraham. And in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. The seed promise, again, just like to Abraham. He's the one that the promises are going to be going through now. And he says, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you till I've done what I've said. And I put in bold that I will bring you back to this land because when he does start on the way back, he's very nervous about what Laban is going to do when he catches up to him. And he's also very nervous about what Esau is going to do as he heads further south and comes across Esau. Maybe he forgets that the Lord said, I'll bring you back. I'll be with you everywhere you go. He wakes up in the morning and he says, Surely the Lord is in this place. And I did not know it. And I didn't know what to make of that phrase. I did not know it. You know, when we think of the Lord, we think he is omnipresent. He's everywhere. There's nowhere we can go without the Lord being there. Did Jacob think, like the Canaanites, that the Lord was the Lord of the hills or the Lord of the valley or, you know, just of a specific region? Or was he putting a special emphasis that there was a special place for the Lord here? And maybe that's it, because he says this is the house of the Lord and renames it to be Bethel. And he says, how awesome is this place? And maybe Sunday we'll talk a little bit more about that. So, next morning, he worships God, and he does that by taking that rock, that pillar, and he pours oil on top of it. And he vows that God would be his God if he would provide bread, clothing, and come back to his father's house in peace. So even though he's coming from a rich family, Isaac was very rich. His grandfather Abraham was very rich. He's not asking for a lot. He's just asking for bread and clothing and come back to his father's house in peace. And it reminds you of what Paul says in 1 Timothy 6:8, and having food and clothing with these, we shall be content. So there's probably a good lesson there for all of us. And then he said, whatever you give me, I will give a tenth back to you. And I really read through that statement quite a few times in the past and didn't think a lot about it. But you know, today, if we think about giving something to the Lord, I guess one of the first things that we think about is putting it in the contribution. Of course, there's a lot of different ways that we can give, but that's one of the ways that we think about. How was Jacob going to give this tenth back to the Lord? I don't know that we know the answer to that. But at least one thing came to my mind was that a lot of times when I'm reading through the Old Testament and I see these main characters, I think there is nobody else out there that's trying to serve God other than these main characters. And I think we see that that isn't true. You go back to Genesis chapter 14, and we see Abraham, and he's returning from the war with the kings, right? And he's bringing back Lot, his nephew, and their possessions, and all the other people. And who goes out to meet him but Melchizedek? And who is he called? He is the king of Salem, the king of peace, and he is called the priest of God Most High. So in the Old Testament, Melchizedek isn't what you would call the main character. We don't read about a lot about him in the Old Testament. Probably get more about him talked about in the New Testament. But yet, he was the priest of the Most High God. And also it was brought up to me about Jethro. He was called the priest of Midian. Remember, he was Moses' father-in-law. And in Exodus chapter 18 and in verse 12, it says, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. It seems like that Jethro was accepted by Aaron and the other Israelites for what he was doing, for making this sacrifice to God, that he really was a priest to God. Whether that's true or not, I think we can see that there are other people who are out there trying to serve God, and maybe, we don't know for sure, or at least I don't know for sure, that that was what Jacob had in mind when he said, I'll give you back a tenth. Questions or comments about that? Brent?
God has given us what we need. He's pointing ahead. And maybe to try to figure out all the gaps. We get lost sometimes trying to figure out the data and the gaps. We need to just look at what's there, look ahead at what he's pointing to. Mm-hmm. Good points there.
Okay. And Brent brings up that you know, there's quite a bit that we're not given, you know, all the answers to, but maybe they point to what's fixing to come ahead. So that's a good comment. Okay, so Jacob renames Luz to Bethel. And the town of Bethel is mentioned several times in the Old Testament. There's quite a bit of history there in the Old Testament that occurs in the town of Bethel. Because of time, I'm not going to go through all of these, but maybe sometime do a look up on Bethel and see all the different things that happened there. So, Jacob goes on his way. He makes it up to Haran. He stops at a well outside of the town. And this reminds me so much of when Abraham's servant goes up there to look for Isaac's wife, and he stops at a well outside of the town. Well, Jacob stops there, and he asks about Laban, how he's doing. And they say, yeah, we know Laban. He's doing well. And in fact, here comes his daughter, Rachel, now with his flock. And she comes there, and there's this discussion about watering the flocks and when to do it and everything. But Jacob takes the rock off the well. He waters the flock, and he has an emotional time with Rachel and tells her, I'm your kin. And she runs off to tell Laban, her dad, Jacob's uncle. And he runs then to back to Jacob to meet him. And again, it makes you think about when Abraham's servant was up there, who was it that came out to the well to meet him? It was Laban. At that point, he had seen the nose ring and the bracelets that Rebekah had. Jacob doesn't have any of those kind of things, but he goes out to meet him, and he brings him back to the house. He embraces him, and he kisses him. So things are going well at this point. After a month, Laban says to Jacob, it wouldn't be right for you to work for me for nothing. What kind of wages do you want? And Jacob loved Rachel. And so he says, I will work for you for 7 years for Rachel. Again, I keep going back to this time when Abraham's servant goes up, but there's such a contrast there. When Abraham's servant went up, what did he bring? He had 10 camels worth of Abraham's goods, expensive stuff. Really good stuff that he could give to the wife-to-be and to the family. Jacob comes up, and what does he have? He's got nothing. We saw where he had some oil to pour on the rock back at Bethel, and later on he says, when I crossed over the Jordan, I had a staff in my hand. He's got nothing. He's got nothing to offer but his labor here for Rachel. And so Laban agrees to that. And it says, so Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Okay? So he was smitten. At the end of the 7 years, he goes to Laban and says, I've done my duty. Give me my wife. Laban throws a big feast for the men of the area, and he brings Leah to Jacob. One of the questions that I guess we're not given the answer to is, how was it that Jacob didn't recognize that it was Leah? And I don't know the answer to that. I read where somebody speculated, you know, it was dark. Sisters may have the same body build. They may have similar voices. I don't know the answer. I do think this very strongly indicated that Leah had to have been in on this. Or she could have come into Jacob and said, hey, I'm Leah, I'm not Rachel. She could have been upfront about it, but apparently did not. And so she was in on this deception. Next morning, Jacob wakes up, finds out what happened, and he is upset, as you would expect for him to be. He goes to Laban. And Laban says it's not right for the younger to be married before the younger. And of course, he could have told Jacob that years ago, but he didn't. And he says, give Leah her week and then serve me 7 more years for Rachel. In other words, a honeymoon week, and then Rachel comes into your family. You have 2 wives then, and you're going to be working 14 years, essentially. At this point, Laban would be 84 years old. And the deceiver was deceived. Jacob, who had deceived his father, has now been deceived by Laban. And I can't remember who I got this from, but I stole this. I thought it was really good. Author is James E. Smith. He says, though indefensible on Laban's part, the substitution of Leah for Rachel was a deserved punishment for Jacob. Having wronged Esau, his brother, he is wronged by a brother or relative. Having substituted the younger himself for the older Esau in the birthright, he is recompensed by having the older Leah put into the place of the younger Rachel. As Isaac knew not when he blessed Jacob, so Jacob knows not when he marries or lies with Leah. And as Jacob acted at the instigation of his mother, Rebekah, Leah yields to the suggestion of her father. So I thought that was a pretty good synopsis of what's happening here. Questions or comments about that? Okay. So now Jacob's got two wives, and he loves one of them much more than the other. Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. And over the next 7 years, Jacob is going to have 12 children. We normally talk about the 12 sons of Israel, right? But only 11 of the sons are going to be born while he's in Haran. Benjamin will be born later when Jacob is back between Bethel and Bethlehem, I believe it is. But anyways, he has 11 boys, and he has the one daughter, Dinah, while they are there. And because there are 12 children, and they're born in a 7-year time span, and because we're not told that there was more than one at a time, in other words, we're not told anyways that there were any twins or triplets or anything like that, then there must have been some overlap in the pregnancies of the four women that bear children for Jacob. 12 kids, 7 years and under. Wow! that must have been an exciting time. Okay. We start talking about the children as they're born. And I tell you, this is, to me, some of the saddest. I mean, you're talking about children being born, but this is such a sad story because you see Leah here, who was thrown in the deal, if you will, for the marriage. And she wants Jacob to love her, but Jacob loves Rachel. And so when her children are born, she bears the first four. And when Reuben is born, Leah says, "Now therefore my husband will love me." When Simeon is born, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved. Levi, my husband will become attached to me. And when Judah is born, now I will praise the Lord. You can just see she's pleading. She wants so much for Jacob to love her. Rachel's jealous. She hasn't had any children yet, and she goes to Jacob and says, "Give me children or else I die." What a hard place she's trying to put Jacob in. He says, "Am I in the place of God? I'm not the one who's withholding children from you." And so she says, "I'll give you my maid, Bella, and we'll have children through her." And again, that goes back to that story of Sarah and Hagar. Had Jacob not heard how that turned out, you would think that if he had, he wouldn't go on with this. And had he not told that to Rachel, whether he had or he hadn't, it would be speculation on my part. He goes ahead with this. When Bella bore Dan, Rachel says, "The Lord has given me a son." And when she bore Naphtali, Rachel said, "I have prevailed over my sister." Not just happy to have a child, but "I have prevailed." This is some kind of contest with my sister, Leah. What a messed up family. How this knocking on heads between two sisters because of this marriage relationship is so very sad. So Leah sees that she's not having children anymore, so she gives her maid Zilpah to Jacob, again, like Sarah and Hagar. And when Zilpah's firstborn comes along, Gad, Leah says, "A troop comes. And Asher, I am happy, for the daughters will call me blessed." Leah's son, Reuben, again, he's going to be 7 years old or younger at this point. He goes out and finds some mandrakes. I'm not exactly sure what all mandrakes are. From what reading I could find, they're a plant. They're like potatoes. They grow underground, at least the main part of them. Again, I don't know a lot about them. But Reuben goes out and gets these mandrakes. Rachel sees them and says, I want them. Leah says to Rachel, isn't it enough that you stole my husband and you want my son's mandrakes too? Rachel says, Jacob can lie with you tonight. I just want the mandrakes. And so Leah agrees to that and runs out to Jacob and says, I've hired you tonight with my son's mandrakes. And so Jacob goes into her, with her, and children do come along. Issachar is born. God has given me my wages. I'm sure referring back to the mandrakes. And then Zebulun, now my husband will dwell with me. Again, Leah is still feeling unloved. And then Dinah was born. Again, I don't know a lot about mandrakes. I just put this up there, something that I read off of BibleTalkClub.net. They're used for medicinal purposes, at least according to this website. Sometimes for joint pain, for other infections. They used to be called love apples by the Greeks and thought to have been used as an aphrodisiac. I even read in one place where they could be used as a hallucinogenic. I don't know how much of that is true. Maybe y'all can help me with, you know, more details about that at some point. Then it says, God remembered Rachel. And she bore a son, Joseph, and said, God has taken away my reproach, her reproach from not having any children. Okay, so this has got to be right at the very end of the 14 years that he has agreed to work for Laban. Questions or comments about that? Okay, so we saw that Leah had the first four, Bilhah the next two, Zilpah the next two, Leah the next three, and then Rachel won Joseph. We've talked a lot about how Leah was unloved by Jacob, or at least, at the very least, loved a lot less than Rachel. But I stole the next few slides, I think it was from Wayne, how Leah and her descendants play such a large role, though, in the Bible story. Okay? She was the actual mother of six sons and half of the 12 patriarchs. Okay? And she had one daughter, Dinah. Her son, Judah, succeeded to the headship of the chosen nation through whom the Messiah was born. Her posterity became the principal element in the true Israel. In other words, when you had the divided kingdom, the upper part, the northern kingdom, was called Israel. The southern kingdom was often referred to as Judah. And of course, that would have been her descendants. David the king, who gave his name and title to Christ himself, was her descendant. Her son, Judah, gave his name and title to Christ, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And she was buried in the same cave as Jacob. I thought that was good. And then Rachel, she went to Jacob and said, give me children or else I die. And she angered Jacob in this because he wasn't in the place of God. And she was the one who introduced the concubines into the family, even though Leah went ahead and did that also. Okay, questions or comments about that? I wish I could say that was mine, but I thought that was real good. Okay. At the end of the 14 years, Jacob goes to Laban and says, I've worked out those 14 years. I have performed my duty. Give me my children and my wives and let me go. Time to go home. Laban wants him to stick around because he can see that God is blessing him, blessing Laban, because Joseph is around. And then he says those three words that all of us that work for somebody else would just love to hear. Name your wages. And so Jacob names his wages. He says, I'll take the speckled and the spotted sheep and the goats and the brown lambs. And Laban's pretty happy about this because those aren't the predominant colors of the lambs or the sheep or the goats. And so he says, yeah, let's go with that. Let it be like you said. And so he separates out those that are already born that are like that, and he puts 3 days' journey in between Jacob's flock and his flock. Have you ever thought, how much land did they have? How much land did Laban have that he can put 3 days' journey between Jacob's flock and his flock? Maybe it was free range. I don't know. But to me, this seems like a lot of territory to cover. Okay. We see where God really comes into this and blesses Jacob, because it's really a strange story to me how Jacob causes there to be those speckled and spotted and striped sheep by putting these almond and chestnut rods into the troughs whenever they're about to have babies, and it causes them to have the colors that Jacob said that he wanted. He did it when there were only the strong animals there. And of course, you know, what does that got to do with the colors of the sheep and goats? And we can see that God was definitely playing a part in this. And because of this, Laban is left with a feeble flock, and Jacob has a strong livestock, large flocks, female and male servants, camels and donkeys. He has become rich. He crossed over with just a staff to walk with. But now he's a very rich man. And this doesn't even include what he's going to have whenever he goes back to Isaac. We can see from all this children, we go back to the idea, you're going to be a great nation. And as the stars of the sky, and we can see with all these kids, it's really about to become true. I'll go through this very quick. Love is the strongest motivator to fulfill one's obligations. And we see that with Jacob, how he loved Rachel so much and was willing to work 14 years essentially for her. And in 1 John 5 and in verse 3, it says, "This is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not burdensome." If we truly love God, following Him will not be burdensome. It will be the encouragement, the motivator that we need to do what He said. Those who mistreat others often suffer similar punishment. Jacob deceived his dad. Jacob was deceived by his uncle. And in Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 27 it says, "Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and he who rolls a stone will have it roll back on him." We can see that sometimes, maybe even in our own lives. And God continued to fulfill His promises providentially, using both good and bad choices from man. And I think Brent covered this well on Sunday, that even though Jacob and Isaac and Rebecca and all these different people made good choices and they made bad choices, God was able to carry out His will and carry on the promises that He had given to Abraham years ago. I appreciate y'all's patience tonight and for your help. Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask you, I know it might be a tip of an iceberg, but as I've been studying this, you guys and stuff here, it's something that just kind of bothers me. And the Old Testament conflicts with the New Testament on things like love, adultery, deceit, hate, being forthright, and just goes on. Can you, if you were, just relate what your thoughts might be on the realism of how we live our lives under the new covenant?
Okay. Probably takes more time than what I've got. Dean was asking about, we see all of these evil that are people, lies and deceit and stuff that people do in the Old Testament. And how does that really relate to us? I think Brent has made some really good comments about that. That God does not say that these evil things that these people did back then were good. But He does show that those people did that. I don't think we are told not to lie. I don't think that God is encouraging us by when we read these stories in the Old Testament, that we are to lie, are to deceive others. He's showing us how real people are. But that doesn't mean that he agreed with everything that they did. I hope that helps.